We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So these are these beautiful words that were written centuries ago, and we still quote them today as an inspiration for us on how we as a country should live. And I imagine that none of us will ever speak or write such important words on our own. These words, of course, were written in the Declaration of Independence, largely by Thomas Jefferson. So let me read these again. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And yet, in action, Thomas Jefferson was also a slave owner. He owned over 600 slaves as property, even though he often wrote and spoke in opposition to slavery in our country. So how could his actions and his words be so inconsistent? And today, it's hard for us, even 200 years later, we can't really separate Thomas Jefferson's legacy from his actions, from his deeds. Because no matter how great and beautiful and motivating and powerful and even true your words are, your actions speak louder than words. Your actions and your words speak to your character. And so this inconsistency between our words and actions, it isn't just a phenomenon that has happened in history. It's something that continues to happen today in all areas of leadership. We see that in politics today, whether it's a blue leader or a red leader, as far as the politics go, whether Democrat or Republican, we see that politicians, they make promises to their voters on how they're going to represent them, how they're going to protect them. But these words oftentimes aren't as important to the people as their actions, right? They can make promises, but what really affects the people that they take care of are their actions, how they vote, how they work hard. And oftentimes, the promises they make are in direct opposition to what they actually do. And so we see this in how they write, how they speak, how they tweet. All of those promises don't actually always show up in their actions. The same is true with business leaders today. They make promises so that they can sell a product, and those promises sound good, but then when they decide to their actions, I think they consider more how much money they can make. And so maybe their actions and their promises aren't the same. And it's true of religious leaders as well. Religious leaders can preach against things that they oftentimes are doing themselves in private, hiding from other people. The news is filled with stories of all of these leaders who their character harms us in major ways. We all suffer when the people around us are men and women in leadership but who don't have character. And for ourselves as well, when we lack character, we harm ourselves. We harm our relationships. We harm ourselves in our jobs. We suffer deeply from pain and anxiety caused by our own lack of character. So in this new teaching series that we're calling Louder Than Words, we want to talk about how we as a church can be a people of character. So it's important that we talk about what is character. So our teaching team read a book together called Louder Than Words by Anthony Stanley. We enjoyed that book. We learned a lot from the book. We recommend, if you are interested in reading along with us during this series, you're going to learn a lot as well. It's actually a book that we have on our list for our leaders in leadership community. We have a list of books that we recommend our leaders to read. That's on the list. It's a great book. But as we read together, our teaching team, and we discussed Andy Stanley's definition that he uses in the book for character, it didn't really work for us. And maybe it's just because our unique stories, our church history, our own church baggage a little bit, or maybe it's just because character is hard to define. But many times, character is defined kind of by following all the rules. And we really thought that we wanted to be careful that that isn't how we define character. While obeying Jesus is certainly a part of our character, I believe it goes way beyond just behavior. It goes beyond a list of do's and don'ts. So I'm going to give you just a few definitions that I like that kind of help us a little bit see what character really means. The first one is this: character is doing the right thing when nobody is looking. Or another one is, character is how you treat those who can do nothing for you. Or, character is what a man or a woman is in the dark. What these quotes are getting at is that living a life of character is living an undivided life, that our heart and our beliefs and our words and our actions aren't separate from one another. They're undivided, they're whole. And it's really rare for us to find people of character. And the truth is that I imagine for all of us, we have been hurt at times by people who have said one thing and acted a different way. And we might even doubt that there really are people out there with character, maybe even especially in the church. But when you do find somebody who lives a life where they're really striving to live this undivided life, where they not only believe in Jesus, but they're really striving to live like Jesus in all areas of their life, it really brings you a sense of peace and calm to be near them. So as I was writing this message, I had this memory that came to mind that kind of worked for me of just an image of what character is. So the summer after my freshman year in college, I came home and I worked my first full-time job. So I learned a lot about hard work that summer. I worked at a daycare center all summer long with two-year-olds. So hard, long hours, not a lot of pay. I worked with a variety of people from all ages and races and backgrounds. My co-teacher was in her 70s, and I wasn't even 20 yet at the time. I learned a lot about working with kids. As you can imagine, I did a lot of potty training that summer that came in handy years later. So I learned a lot. But I also learned something that I didn't really expect to learn about work. So one of the reasons why I took this job in particular was because it was in walking distance from where my dad's office was. And so we would ride to work together, and then after work, I got out about a half an hour before my dad did. So I would walk over to his office, and then the idea was that we would leave together. But what happened was I would get there, and he wasn't ready to go. So I should tell you that my dad worked his whole career as a soil scientist for the state of Ohio. So government jobs have a lot of great benefits, insurance benefits, a lot of benefits that it's really kind of hard to lose your job. There's a lot of job security in government work oftentimes if your budget isn't cut. It wasn't a glamorous, it wasn't a huge prestigious job, but it was a good job for my dad. But one of the things over the years that I learned was that there's a lot of criticism, sometimes joking about government workers and how because they have so much job security that they don't really work very hard. And I remember that that kind of hurt my dad's feelings. And I remember that he was a hard worker. And so I got, you know, of course that hurt his feelings. But when I would go to meet my dad after work, you know, we had a set time that he was going to clock out. He was going to be done and he was going to leave. But every time I got there at that set time, he would take like 15, 20 minutes to kind of get himself ready and, you know, set the desk up and leave it all neat and clean. And I kind of got frustrated. I was like, we had this time that you were going to get out of here, and then, you know, I have to wait around. And so I think as a 19-year-old, I might have even just kind of complained to him a little bit. And I was like, Dad, what's going on? I thought, you know, maybe he could manage his time well. And me working a full-time job for the first time this summer, I thought I could advise him. But I remember what he said. He said, and here's my dad, he's working in an office by himself with the behind closed doors. What he said was, each day he signed in to work, what time he arrived and started working. And each day he signed out what time he was leaving, what time he was done working. That's what, to him, it meant. And so for him, when he signed out, he wanted to make sure he was working up until that time. And getting ready for the next day, that to him didn't count. For his own sense of integrity, he had to work up until that moment that he signed out. Nobody was watching him do that. I just happened to see it and kind of figure out that he did that. Now, I tell that story not because I think it's really important that we all work like my dad, who, you know, never checks Facebook or the news while he's working. I'm getting on you about that at all. But what I am talking about is that we all have these opportunities throughout our day to be people of character, and that people around us are watching us, people that we share the train with, people on the elevator, our coworkers, our neighbors, our super, our children, our family. They're all watching how we live, and it shows in our character. So I think that the best example of living this undivided life for us isn't my father, for sure. He's broken just like all of us. He tries, but he isn't the perfect example of living this undivided life. The perfect example, of course, is Jesus. He lived this completely consistent life. His heart and his actions and his thoughts and his words were completely consistent with one another. His life wasn't about keeping the rules. It was about living a life of light, because there was no darkness in him. There was no ego, no selfishness, no avoidance of negative emotions, no greed or pride. What was in his heart was completely pure, and it showed in his actions and his words to the people he met. And so many of these people that we see him meeting, they had nothing to offer him. And yet he still treated them all the same. And at the time, the religious leaders around him were kind of shocked by this behavior. He didn't act like everybody else. So at the time, the Jewish religious leaders, they had great character to themselves because they kept all the rules, right? They were important and they had great positions and privilege because they kept all the rules. They knew all the rules and they kept all the rules. And so to kind of explain what that means is, you know, at one point, God gives Moses in the Old Testament, you can read in the Bible, that he starts by giving Moses the Ten Commandments. And this is just a way for the Jewish people to live in a way that they can follow God. And then he gives them additional rules as a way to kind of stay distinct from other people. But over the years, the Jews had added more and more rules to those original rules. And a good way to look at them is as hedge rules or border rules. So this idea that they're adding more rules around the original rules so that you can't even get close to breaking those original rules. So they just created more and more and more rules, and it was harder and harder not to break the rules. And so they were very prideful because they knew the rules and they knew how to keep them. And then Jesus comes along and he isn't like that, and they don't know what to do with him. And so I would like for us to kind of look at a passage in Luke chapter 6 and see just how Jesus interacts with the rules and interacts with these people, and how we can see kind of how his heart is consistent with his actions. So we're going to look in Luke chapter 6. I don't have slides because it's a long passage, but if you have your Bible with you or a Bible app, you can follow along. But I'm going to read with you this passage. So in verse 1 of Luke chapter 6, it says, "One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and his disciples began to pick up some heads of grain and rub them in their hands and ate the kernels. And some of the Pharisees asked, 'Why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?'" So this rubbing their hands together and separating the kernels was work, what they considered work. So he was breaking the rules to eat. And Jesus answered them. He said, have you never read what King David did when he and his companions were hungry? So, of course, Jesus is talking about King David, a great Jewish leader that they would have respected. He says about David, he says, he entered the house of God, and taking the consecrated bread, he ate what was lawful only for priests to eat, and he also gave some of it to his companions. So he's giving them an example of somebody who they respected, who broke those border rules that were kind of added. Because what was important to King David was that he fed the people he loved. And then Jesus says to them, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. So he's calling himself the Son of God here, which of course is angering them. And then he's also saying that he's Lord, that he's above the Sabbath, that he's above the rules that they have created, that that isn't what the Sabbath is about. And then there's another incident where that happens on the Sabbath. It says, on another Sabbath, he went into the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was shriveled. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. So they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. But Jesus knew what they were thinking. And he said to the man with the shriveled hand, get up and stand in front of everybody. And so he got up and he stood there. And then Jesus said to them, I ask you, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it? And he looked around at them, and he said to the man, stretch out your hand. So clearly, it seems easy to us, right? Healing is the right answer. Doing good is the right answer. But not to these leaders. The Pharisees, it says, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. They were furious not because he didn't heal. They were furious because he healed somebody, and that was work, so he was breaking the rules. Jesus didn't fit into their idea of character, because character to these religious leaders was about keeping the rules. It was about knowing the law and keeping the rules. But that isn't how Jesus lived. He lived completely sinless life. There was nothing that he did that got in between him and God. He followed God in everything he did. It was a completely sinless life. But he was also motivated in all of his actions by this pure and loving, undivided heart. So Webster's Dictionary, if you look up what they say character is, they define it as moral excellence. But for those of us who know and follow Jesus, we have this perfect example of moral excellence. And that example is Jesus. So here's my definition for character. Jesus is our definition of character. That's why we strive to be more and more like him. Our character, it isn't stagnant. It doesn't stay the same for years. God's love for us, it never changes. It isn't dependent on how we act. But our character is constantly changing. We might not be able to notice the change in ourselves, but our character is changing. The change is there. A couple weeks ago, my niece came back for a visit to the United States. She's been living in Nairobi, Kenya for a year. And so she's 12, so we haven't seen her for a whole year. And so she came back. She's the youngest of the 7 granddaughters in my family. And she came back taller than everybody else. All the other 7, all the other 6 granddaughters, she outgrew her 2 aunts. She outgrew her grandmother, which honestly isn't that hard because we're all like 5 feet tall. But we could see, we were kind of shocked by the change. All of a sudden, you know, she's 12 and we're looking up to her now, and the change is really noticeable to us. But for her parents, the change, it happened on a much smaller scale. They can't really place the time where the change happened, but certainly they see the result of the growth. And that is true of our life following Jesus. We should always be changing and growing and becoming a bit more like Jesus. It's never okay for us to think, you know, I think I'm good now. I think I've got it together. And, you know, I know there's that part of me that isn't like Jesus, but I think that's okay. We'll just stick with having that around. Because if we do that, that part of us, that's the part that's going to grow as well. It will grow and it will grow and it will show in our character. For me, the best description of how change takes place in us is the kind of the description of going from complete darkness to complete light. It's this gradual transition that happens each morning. You can't place one moment where it changes. It takes time. But each morning we see it change, and it's beautiful to watch it happen. As the sun rises, the darkness starts to disappear. But there are still places where the sun doesn't quite hit yet. These little shadows that are still surrounded by sunlight. And I think we all have shadows in our lives as well. Places that God hasn't quite yet transformed. Perhaps there are things that we don't like to talk about with others. We feel shame about in our shadows. Sometimes we're just even afraid to look at them and to get rid of these shadows. We're so used to having them in our lives. So Pete Scazzaro is a pastor and writer. We've learned quite a lot from him at Everyday Church. He wrote Emotionally Healthy Spirituality. He and his wife wrote the curriculum for the class that we teach here each fall. And he also wrote a book called The Emotionally Healthy Leader. And in that book, he talks about our shadows and that all of us have kind of a shadow, those places in our lives that God hasn't quite transformed. And he defines the shadow as this. He says, the shadow is the accumulation of untamed emotions, less than pure motives and thoughts that, while largely unconscious, they still strongly influence and shape our behaviors. And it's the damaged, most hidden version of who you are. So he talks about the problem of ignoring those shadows and that they will come out in our behavior. And so he gave a list of examples of how they'll show up in our behavior. He said they can show up when you act out inappropriately, when you're under pressure, or how you don't want someone to succeed because they've hurt you, or you're triggered by a person or a circumstance and say things and then you later regret what you said. You disregard your spouse or your coworker or your friend when they bring up a difficult issue about you and your behavior. You keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, even though the consequences always are negative. You're angry, jealous, and envious a lot. You do and say things out of fear of what other people might think about you. You get busier rather than reflective when you are anxious. You tend to idolize others who seem to be given special gifts by God, and you forget that they too have a shadow, that they're broken as well. You will make negative comments to others about those who frustrate you rather than going to them directly. So I think for all of us, we can kind of see how those shadows might affect us in our character. So I have a friend who I was sharing with this week, and she was talking to me about a close friend of hers who I kind of knew this guy's story, and she was talking to me about what he's going through and how he's doing. So I know that he has a hard story. I know that his childhood was really rough, and he doesn't really talk about it. He doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to look at it. He's never done counseling, or he can't even talk to the people closest to him about it. And I also know that he's a kind person, that he loves his family, and he loves Jesus. But over the years, he has really struggled with some really destructive behavior. His drinking has become worse and worse. He used to kind of be able to hide how much he was drinking, and only a few people knew about it. But then it just got out of hand, and it started destroying a lot of his life. And as that addiction got worse and worse, so was his addiction with pornography. And that kind of led to going to chat rooms, which then led to him meeting women. And, you know, before that, he never meant to cross any of those lines. But lines were crossed, and it just got harder and harder to hide it all. And he hit rock bottom when his wife knew it all and just said, "I'm done." She was done, and she's done with her marriage and their family and lots of kids. They're all going to be split up. So as my friend was talking to this man, he was sharing about how much God was doing in his life, and he was admitting his addictions and saying that he really believed God was healing him. And my friend said to him, she said, "That's great. You know, I know Jesus has the power to heal you and help you, but you have to look at that stuff. You got to look at that stuff you never wanted to look at, because that's what allowed you to kind of start on this path." So what she was talking about is a perfect example of the shadow. It's an extreme cautionary, but it's a real life example of how ignoring one's shadow allows it to grow, and it shows up in these destructive behaviors. And when I hear his story, I have so much compassion and mercy and grace for him, because I know his story, and I know he didn't create that shadow. It was created for him in his childhood. He's a victim of it. And he knows and he loves Jesus, but knowing Jesus isn't enough for him. He also needs to let Jesus transform him, as we all do, to be more like Jesus, especially in those dark places that we don't want to look at. So I don't know if you remember being a child and having to sleep by yourself, like that stage where you're... parents said, "No, stay in your bed. You got to sleep in your bed by yourself." Or maybe you're a parent and you're still working on this. And we kind of come up with all these skills and practices that we try to do. You know, first is a pacifier. I was never good at this. My kids now sleep by themselves, but they're teenagers, so that isn't saying much. But it took us years. We won't go into that, but, you know, you start with the pacifier, then you might go to a stuffed animal they can sleep with, and then a blanket. You might lay down with them for a long time. You sing to them, you read a story, you pray with them, all these things to just kind of get them used to being in their bed by themselves. And then there's a stage where you've got to take some of that away, because really, when they're teenagers, you can't lay down with them every night and wait till they fall asleep. You know, they got to do that on their own. So at some point, sometimes kids will say, "You know, it's time, Mom. I'm ready. I can do this by myself." That's pretty rare. Usually, you kind of have to encourage it in your child and kind of tell them it's time for a change. You know, some parents do this. Unfortunately, they'll do this by kind of making fun of their kids. They think that will motivate them. They'll say, "You're being a baby. Babies don't need this anymore. You're not a baby, are you? You don't want to be a baby." Or some parents think it's easiest to just kind of take it away and just say, how it is. I'm the parent. I'm taking this away. You don't need it anymore. But most parents, hopefully, are patient. And they talk to their children, and they gently encourage their child to give it a try. Whatever they're clinging to still, give it a try. Let it go. And I know that there are some people in this room this morning that don't really know who Jesus is, this Jesus that we talk so much about. And that's okay. You're not really sure which parent I just described is how Jesus relates to us. So that makes sense to us. You don't know Jesus? That makes sense that you don't know how to trust him yet. So right now, your job is just to learn more about Jesus. You just need to get to know him and figure out who he is and if you can trust him. And I know that what you're going to learn is that he is patient. He's extremely patient, more patient than anybody you will ever meet. You're going to learn that he is gentle and that he is kind and that he deeply loves you. So here at Everyday Church, we are committed to also being patient. It's okay that you don't know who Jesus is yet. You can ask your questions. It's okay. And you can belong here no matter what you believe about Jesus. But for those of us who do know Jesus and who have chosen to follow him, let Jesus gently and patiently encourage you to change, to grow, to look at your shadow, and to work to be more like Jesus. It might mean that right now you might feel like God is calling you to commit to taking the emotionally healthy skills class that we offer in the fall. Maybe for the first time, maybe for the sixth time. That's okay. And it's a great way to kind of look at your shadow and start looking at how you can love more like Jesus. Or maybe you feel like this is time to go to counseling and maybe look at some things that you haven't wanted to look at in your past or your family of origin. If that's how you're feeling and you don't know where to start, we would love for Larry and I come and talk to us. We've helped so many people find Christian counseling. We can help financially if that is keeping you from going to counseling. We really see the benefit of looking at those shadows with a Christian counselor and trying to work out a healthy way to deal with them. Or maybe it's just that you feel like God is calling you to confess what you're dealing with, what you're struggling with somebody that you really trust here at church, just so they can pray with you and it isn't hidden anymore. Maybe just the first step is just to admit it to God. Admit your struggles to God. He knows them already, but just invite him to help you work on those areas in your life. And the Holy Spirit can help you in the struggle to turn any darkness into light. I know for me, there's areas that are still a struggle for me that I don't want to look at, but we don't need to be afraid. So when we look at the life of a man named Peter, as we're looking in the New Testament, we read a lot about a man named Peter. We see a lot of his life. So we read about in the Gospels the very first time that Jesus calls Peter, this man who used to be Simon, and then he changes his name to Peter, and he says, "Come and follow me." And the kids actually downstairs are learning that story this week. And Peter, he chooses to follow Jesus, but his life isn't quite transformed. We see this long process of him becoming more and more like Jesus. And he spends 3 years with Jesus. And still, even at the end of those 3 years, he still makes mistakes. He still doesn't get it quite right. And then as Jesus, after Jesus' death and resurrection, and he goes back to heaven, he puts Peter kind of as a leader in charge of the church. Still, Peter's learned a lot, but he still makes mistakes. Right? He kind of, Paul has to correct him, and he is repentant, and he changes and continues to get the heart of Jesus. So at the end of Peter's life, he writes 2 letters to churches in the area, and he's just kind of giving his wisdom of a life following Jesus. And we refer to these letters as 1st and 2nd Peter, and I just want to read a passage in the second letter, 2 Peter, chapter 1, verse 3. This is what Peter says to us. He says, "God's divine power has given us everything we need for a godly life." God has given us everything we need to live a life of character. And so that's why here at Everyday Church, one of the things we say a lot is that we are all about leading people into life-changing relationships with God and the family of God. Because we need to be changing, little by little, becoming more and more like Jesus. That passage, it continues, it says, "For this very reason, make every effort to add to your faith goodness, and to goodness add knowledge, and to knowledge add self-control, and to self-control, perseverance, and to perseverance, godliness, and to godliness, mutual affection, and to mutual affection, add love. For if you possess these qualities in increasing measure, they will keep you from being ineffective and unproductive in your knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. We don't want to just know Jesus. We want to live like Jesus. So Jesus said these words to us. He says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. He said, I have come into the world as a light so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness. Let's pray.